all so kind.
Right, we're back home now. Pass us your coat, Mark. I'll hang it up.
There you go. Thank you.
Computer, can you close the doors, please, to keep the noise down? Thanks. Well, listeners, you catch us just returning to the Hooseum from our attending a celebration mass across the square at the Cathedral Church of St. Adric the Martyr. In celebration of a new addition to the Hooseum family on the 25th of March, Patrick Troughton's birthday, no less.
Yes, Hayden's very pleased about that. It's almost like he timed it.
Yeah. The Fair Sophie presented Hayden with a bouncing baby boy, and Hayden is currently on paternity leave. You'll probably just hear, just before the doors were closing there, the sound of the Queen's Own Johnny Who Entertainers giving us a 21-gun salute across the square. So, congratulations from the two of us to Hayden.
Yes.
We've already started manufacturing diddly-dum baby grows to provide in bulk to the happy couple. Happy couple? That's a wedding, isn't it? To the proud parents. I'm not quite sure what we're going to do, Mark, with the recording podcast now, because Hayden's going to be on maternity leave for a while. I'm not sure if just the two of us would work well, because we don't particularly like each other, do we?
No, I mean, there's no chemistry.
I mean, Hayden is just about manages to keep us apart from the fisticuffs, doesn't he?
And also, I mean, there's just no spark without Hayden's Piers Morgan-type persona.
I think we're going to have to start inviting some guests on from other podcasts, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
That Dave Kitchen suggested that he won't come along, but being an Aussie, I'm not sure if we should really trust him with our address to you.
Mm.
You don't just give it to anyone. And listening to some of those podcasts he records, I'm not entirely sure of his bona fides. So I think it's best if we keep the address from him. Oh! Old Soothsayer, could you answer the phone, please?
Hello, this is the Diddly Dum Hooseum. Will we accept a reverse charge call from Australia? Yes, I think we can afford it. Go ahead, please.
Meanwhile, in an underground cave in Australia.
Damn it! Travis has escaped with that copy of the Rev's brain print, and now I'll never discover the location of the Hooseum. But what was it that old Soothsayer said? A fool knows everything and nothing? A fool knows everything and nothing.
The location of the Diddly Dum Hooseum is at number 1 Biscuit Factory Square, Lethbridge, in the county of Marmoset.
Of course! That must have been a trigger phrase. I'd better hurry back and teleport to the HMS Adric, and then on with luck to the Hooseum.
Oh, someone at the door. Can we open the front door, please, computer? Golly, it's Dave himself.
Dave, have you murdered your way to the wall of the Hooseum?
It's an old wall, Mark. It waits. I hope you don't die before it's edited.
Dave, welcome to the Whoseum. Now, actually, listeners, what we were doing when Mark and I and Hayden were trying to work out who we should invite, I think one of us suggested, why don't we invite Dave Kitchen? And I said, oh, he's been on already, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think that was me. I suggested it.
Oh, that's it. And I said, really, are you sure? So we went back and checked. So it turned out he hadn't.
Mm.
What we had done, when was it, Dave, that we met you at the Fitzroy Tavern? How long ago was that?
4 years? 5 years? 4 years?
It was January 2016.
Goodness.
I think. Which has gone by no time. Is it 2016?
I'll have a look. Let's have a look.
Or is it 2017? No, I joined in 2016, didn't I? So it must have been January 2017.
It was January 2017. Yeah. Oh, Lord. That was our Surfeit of Beef podcast. just looking at the topics we covered. Meeting Dave Kitchen at the Fitzroy Tavern. Donald Trump's inauguration.
Well, that's definitely the one, because I think I saw the news coverage of Trump's inauguration whilst staying at Audubon, so...
Oh, that's right, yeah. Has Mark's attitude to John Pertwee's authoritarianism changed since fatherhood? Polly gets a velvet jacket for Christmas.
Oh.
A character arc from my... Oh, this must have been when we did our Mike Yates going mad.
I think it was actually a Whomobile related, wasn't it?
What was it? A character arc from Mike Yates. Related?
Did we do Invasion of the Dinosaurs and Planet of the Spiders?
Yes, Invasion and Planet. So we must. So what's the third one? Oh, we've never done Green Death, have we? So that must work out to that, right.
Dave is also a fellow member of the Invasion of the Dinosaurs fan club, isn't he?
Yes, and also a co-contributor to the Horns of Nymon fan club.
Yes, yes, yes.
Of course. Shows how the sadness can spread worldwide.
And the Friends of Adric.
Yeah. So do you want to send your wishes to Hayden and Sophie, Dave?
Yes, good day, chaps. Really excited to be here at the Whoseum. It's even bigger on the inside than I expected, but very impressive. But look, thank you for joining me. I'm a big fan of the podcast. Very happy to be here. But thank you also to Hayden. Congratulations to you and Sophie on the birth of William. And it's even more exciting that the birth of your first child, which is a big deal for you, means I get to fill in for you on paternity leave, which is an even bigger deal for me.
Oh.
Yes, the boy is going to be named William. There's quite a discussion between various possibilities for names. I think it was... here's Hayden's list. Wonderful. Counselor. The Prince of Podcasting.
Ozzy Ardiles, for some reason.
So, what has been happening in our absence from the airwaves? On the 30th of March, we lost Myra Francis, Lady Adrasta. From Creature from the Pit.
I was going to say also, we saw her probably about a year ago when we tried to start watching Survivors.
As Anne Trenter. Now, was she the main woman in it, or is she a...
No, she was the... Do you remember the one in the fur coat who had the husband who... They'd made a base in a quarry, and her husband...
Oh,
they had
yes.
loads and loads of supplies and stuff in like, containers in this, and, like, a porter cabin in this...
He had locked away in a porter cabin. I remember that.
It was a very exciting porter cabin because they went back there several times across the first series, I think.
Oh, do they? Does she recur? Oh, right, interesting.
No, she leaves him, doesn't she? Because some of their supplies fall over. And oh, no, was it a forklift truck?
He certainly is crippled.
Yeah, he gets crippled.
And then she walks out on him and then they... Yeah.
They do return, but we only got a few episodes in before I think it became a little bit too... What with lockdown going on, I think we started to feel the series a little bit too dour for our...
as Hayden says about season one of Blake 7, a bit too bleak for me.
Survivors is very bleak.
We're just coming to the end of... Is it season 3 of The Sweeney at the moment, Mark?
Yes, yeah. Which has been quite a bleak season itself, hasn't it, actually?
Yeah, it has, really.
So...
I also didn't realise that on the 10th of January, this name may not mean anything to the younger listeners among you, but we lost James Follett, maybe best known to Dave as the writer of Dawn of the Gods, from season 3 of Blake 7.
And Star Drive.
Oh, yes, of course. But perhaps better known to many among us from who are avid listeners of BBC radio drama in the 80s, as the guy who wrote Earth Search, brilliant series. And I was thinking about this when I heard about his death. I'm beginning to wonder whether that series wasn't the source of my long-standing campaign for Doctor Who characters to speak and receive pronunciation. Because although the characters in it were a bit early 1980s BBC accents, I think possibly on our last podcast, the penny dropped with me. It's not received pronunciation that I'm interested in. It's just proper enunciation of words. I think it was when we were doing on our last podcast, it was our retrospective of Matt Smith's era and the discovery on the Crimson Horror that Diana Rigg is able to do a broad northern accent and still enunciate every single consonant in her words, unlike the Sheffield accents that have been adopted in recent series. It was a series with umpteen computer voices on it, but instead of having the sort of computer voices you might have on Doctor Who, talking like that sort of thing, it was almost like the robot voices in Robots of Death. They actually had proper actors doing very mellifluous, seductive voices, which I think would sound absolutely glorious on radio. I might find a clip of that somewhere.
Well, I must admit, I was very interested to read that he did have a considerable radio body of work, and I thought it quite appropriate because, unfortunately for him, he wrote two fairly decent scripts for Blake 7, but they're probably two of the stories with the absolute worst production values and direction of anything in the series, particularly Star Drive. I think when he wrote the Space Rats, I don't think he quite appreciated what the designer would put together for their makeup and costumes.
No.
So maybe that's why he stuck to radio from then on, so that designers and directors couldn't ruin his work.
Look down into the pools of time. Look down, down. And you'll see the beginning of time, when the sun was a whirling cloud of contracting gas. And then the sun began to spin faster and faster as it shrank. Then suddenly it threw great clouds of matter out into space. But the sun's gravity was too much for the clouds to escape, so they orbited around the sun. Countless billions of years passed, and then one day, a nearby star, far bigger than the sun, suddenly exploded. And for millions of years, the sun and the clouds of gas going round the sun were bombarded with huge meteoroids. The mighty bombardment ended 4,500 million years ago. And when it was over, instead of clouds of gas orbiting the sun, there were planets. Which bear the marks of that terrible assault to this day. And there they are. You see them? Beautiful children of the sun, moving against the stars as they circle obediently around their mother. There's Malkara, the first of the sun's children, orbiting so closely that her rocks are almost melting and making rivers. Look closer. For now we come to the second planet, the most beautiful of all the 6 children of the sun.
What's that planet?
And you see the moon? In those days, the moon orbited the beautiful planet. Not now, for the beautiful planet has gone.
What happened to it?
The people who lived on the beautiful planet were very clever. For it was they who spread out across the solar systems and plundered the moons of other planets for the minerals that the people of the beautiful planet needed.
What happened to the beautiful planet, Custodian?
One day, Its people became afraid of the sun that had given them warmth and light. They started studying the strange forces of gravity and magnetism that pervade the cosmos. They built several artificial suns to pour down energy on their planet. And when they had mastered the forces of gravity and magnetism, they took their beautiful planet out of the solar system and went in search of a sun that they were not afraid of.
How long ago was this, Custodian?
Time doesn't matter. It's only a legend from before the founding of the Solaric Empire.
What was the name of the beautiful planet, Custodian?
Earth.
Did we read the Radio Times piece on how Christopher Eccleston believes that what Doctor Who needs to do is to explode the cannon?
I did, and look, it's a typical Radio Times title where they sort of said, he wants to explode the cannon, and
yeah.
all he's doing is saying, look, you know, you can't be a slave to cannon, and you can't say, well, the Doctor's got 13 incarnations, so I guess that's that. You have to be a bit flexible, but I totally agree with Eccleston. I think that you should never let slavish adherence to canon ruin the drama. But then I'm probably in a minority in Doctor Who fandom that I reckon that the new series should have been a complete hard reset. Eccleston should have played a completely new First Doctor, and he should have then gone on to meet the Daleks for the very first time and the Master for the very first time, and then done whatever they would have liked with the show, and not sort of say, well, we would like to do this with the Daleks, but unfortunately in 1966 they said this, so we can't do that.
If only the old soothsayer hadn't picked up that phone. We don't allow such heretical views. I never knew you thought that way. That's interesting. So
well,
how would
you... I didn't think it originally, but as the series, as the new series, I should say, went on, I just realised sort of how many opportunities were perhaps missed and how much they sort of had to stick to stuff that maybe could have been a bit more interesting if they didn't have to make it, you know, year 27 of a show, but could have made it year one. It's not a strong view, but I just kind of find that maybe the continuity is a bit limiting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they... I mean, Stephen Moffat could kind of have done that with the Big Bang episode, really, couldn't he? Because it's rebooting, restarting the entire universe, and you could have... I think there's ways of doing it that you could have done it so that actually rebooting the show is part of the canon, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think he definitely could. But in the end, the issue is not so much whether you have continuity in canon or not, but whether the idea is good or not.
Yeah.
And I think the Timeless Child is a really good example of that. I mean, that's what's meant to be a big canon-busting, exciting twist to the series, but it doesn't work, not because it's changing canon. I don't care about that. But
no.
It doesn't work because it's just naff.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it as well. And I get slightly annoyed when people say, oh, well, if you didn't like Timeless Children, then we'd still have had, you know, the show would have stopped after William Hartnell had left the show and,
yes,
and things
exactly.
Like that. Oh, and we wouldn't have ever had Gallifrey, and we wouldn't have ever had Regenerations, and we wouldn't have had this. And it's like, no, that's not the point. The point is that, yeah, I don't mind change, but I don't have to like every change that's made. And not all of the changes, I think, are good or beneficial to the character or the show.
That's right. The reason why we like the changes at the end of the War Games is the War Games is really, really good.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, just a quote from the Radio Times. Ninth Doctor actor Christopher Eccleston has suggested that the BBC sci-fi series needs to explode the canon as he reprises the role for the first time in 16 years. Reprises. I am not a slave to the canon, Eccleston said, while promoting the Ninth Doctor Adventures range of audio dramas from Big Finish. I think if the show wants to survive going forward, it needs to explode the canon. That rigid adherence to there can only be this number of incarnations, etc. It's nonsense. The imagination is limitless. Big Finish's new Ninth Doctor adventures take place before he meets Rose. I think the incarnations thing is a sort of a straw man, really, because I don't think there's a single one of us who seriously thought that once they reached Matt Smith's era, although even that was slightly manipulated by Stephen Moffat so that he could be the one who solved the Regenerations issue, they would say, oh, we'd better cancel Doctor Who now. Everyone knew that they'd just, you know, write it away in one sentence in the script or just ignore the 12 Regenerations thing.
That's exactly right, but I do think that Moffat really missed a trick by solving the problem of regeneration early when he called David Tennant two doctors. Because I just think it would be a really interesting idea if Peter Capaldi had been the final incarnation of the Doctor, certainly as far as the Doctor was concerned, and you start to see this thing of... Because, you know, every time the Doctor's in trouble for the last 40 years, you'd sit there and go, well, you know, absolute worst case scenario, I guess he regenerates.
Yeah.
But if you take that away from the Doctor and say, well, now if you risk your life or you sacrifice yourself, it's the end, you're not going to regenerate, does that change how the Doctor goes about being the Doctor? I think that could have been really interesting, and I think Moffat actually would have written that really well. But in the end, it's kind of just a throwaway thing at the end of Matt Smith's era.
Yes, it's only really that very final episode, Time of the Doctor, isn't it, that it reaches the point where we realise that he's on his last... And also, if they'd done this at the end of Capaldi's era, then you possibly even more justification for changing it to a woman playing the role. You know, you get an entirely new regeneration cycle. Who's to know that wouldn't mean that, what's the word, all bets are off. But I also think that I've seen quite a few people online saying things like, oh yes, I absolutely agree, and this is what Chris Chibnall did with The Timeless Children. But actually, no, he did the opposite. That is essentially based on a lonely teenager's obsession with the extra faces in Brain of Morbius and trying to explain it. I mean, that is being obsessed with canon. The latest DWM 563, there's quite a lot of pieces on Christopher Eccleston. And, I did start banging my head on my desk almost two paragraphs into it. I don't like irony, Chris says at one point in our conversation. I didn't go to Oxbridge. The Doctor is about a full force, heartfelt gut reaction to life. And you think, oh, Christ, he's doing his professional Northerner crap again? I didn't watch The Doctor when I was a kid because he sounded too posh for me. And you think, oh, Christ. This is the guy who, in his book, I Love the Bones of You, actually, what was that line he said? Challenging the institutionally sanctioned smothering of working class hope has been the driving force of my life. No, you don't do irony, do you, Chris? Southern parasites licking the fat of the land while the North lies dying. Seems just a very bizarre thing to say. It's constantly his theme about this. It's a cheesy BBC science fiction. It's not something that's fascinating.
I just love that, like a lot of British people, there's this obsession about the South and the North when you can drive from one to the other in a quiet afternoon. It's not exactly a big geographical distance.
You can drive from the one geographical area to the North in an afternoon. I don't think you can transfer from the one mindset to the other in one afternoon. Oh, what's that? Is that something flying overhead? Just open the window. There's a stork flying overhead. It's got a giant nappy in its beak. It's dropped something down the Hoosium chimney. Quick, guys, to the fireplace. Oh.
Oh, look, there's something wrapped up in a nappy.
It's an audio cassette player.
That's a bit smelly.
A sticker on it. Oh, it's a message from Hayden. Let's play it.
Hi guys, it's Hayden here. Sorry I can't be with you this time out, but I'm afraid that I am locked in the diddly-dum Hoosium crèche at the moment, looking after my son, who, as we speak, might stir and interrupt this voice recording. But anyway, it doesn't matter. While you have David there, I was wondering if I could maybe pose him a question, and your good selves as well, Mark and Doc. Recently we had the Season 8 box sets come out, and I wanted to know what you guys thought about it, and also wanted to know what you thought about this new standardized editions which are coming out of season 12 and 19 on I think it's the 31st of May over here in the UK, and also just get a rough idea about what you think about the future of the releases in this country recently. I think since COVID struck, I think it's become more difficult to actually get the limited edition collection box sets The reason being, I think, is by the sounds of it, is down to problems with stock, problems with some of the distributors. I know Zoom went under, oh, they were bought out, weren't they? Sorry. And then and now they aren't selling them anymore, but they did honour the Season 8 box sets, as far as I'm aware. And Amazon. Now, a little story for you all. Unfortunately for Season 8, I very nearly didn't get it. And we all know that these things are like gold dust, aren't they? Well, Amazon, mine just wasn't dispatching. And after a few days, I sort of followed this up with Amazon and wondered why this was the case. Basically, they couldn't really give me an answer. They said it would be dispatched, but it would be dispatched about 2 weeks later. So anyway, I discovered, thankfully, through the Twitter handle, I think it was Cyberdevil, that's Matthew Purchase, who's pretty hot on these things when it comes to the Blu-rays, noticed that they had some stock in Argos, and luckily I had one down the road. So I went down the road and ordered one and had one, basically had a copy the next day. But just so happened, as I was walking home, Amazon sent me an email to say that I had basically missed out this time. But I don't know, they didn't really give me much of a reason. I think it was something to do with, like I said, you know, the lack of stock. This seems to have happened a lot on Twitter recently. I just wonder, like, when it comes to this limited release that they do for these box sets, whether it can be a hindrance for fans, can't it? I just wonder what you kind of thought about that, and whether you think these standardized editions are going to help. I mean, personally, yes, I do, but I mean, they're that much thinner, aren't they, in size? They don't have the big bulky cases like we've had so far with the previous 8 seasons that have been released up to this point. I'm a little torn on them, actually. I think if I was to miss out on one run again, and by the way, I'm not going to order through Amazon ever again, actually. Often that was my one and only experience with them, buying these box sets. I'd always used Zoom in the past, but I think from now on I'll use HMV because I wasn't very satisfied, and it could mean I missed out on something which is about as rare as a cure for COVID. So personally, I think standard editions are a very good idea. But for some fans who may have wanted a less bulky sort of feel to these, do you think that maybe these have come a little too late, or do you think you will be adapting your, you know, if you miss out, let's say, and then you wait another year or two for the reprint, will you just go then and you won't really be bothered with how they look on the shelf? What do you think? What do you think about them? Firstly, I think it's a great idea to release them in this sort of standard form, and hopefully they're not going to be, I haven't seen any confirmation that they will be, this is a limited edition, they'll just sort of be there for whoever needs them, which I think is a great idea. And do you think this will finally put an end to the ridiculous scalping online as well? I certainly hope so. Anyway, I hope that all made a bit of sense. I'm a little sleep deprived at the moment, but he's doing really well, R. William, and he's really enjoying the baby grow that you all so lovingly got him, Doc and Mark. So I'll say goodbye for now, and I hope I can join you very soon. And take care as well, David. Take care, all. Bye.
So what are our thoughts on these new Blu-ray sets, guys? It's been proposed, isn't it, that instead of these quite giant, quite blocky, thick cardboard Blu-ray collection sets, one season per set, they're now effectively going to give them in what I imagine sounds like being maybe a slightly thicker version of a normal DVD case. Any thoughts?
Well, it actually sounds like a bit of an upgrade to me, because if you've got all the content of the new Blu-rays and it's taking up less shelf space, that to me is an upgrade. So I'm actually almost a little bit miffed that I've been buying all the special expensive limited editions only to find that I actually would have been better off waiting and having saved even more shelf space. But I say that in jest, because there's no way I would have wanted to wait for several years to have all these exactly. And rewatch them again. So,
Doc was furious, weren't he?
No. I've always dreamt of, usually when I've been moving house and it's taken me a whole day to pack all my DVDs up into moving boxes, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if they had... Do you remember when they did... I don't know if you remember... Oh, decades ago, they did the they released the Lost in Time box set, which was all the orphaned episodes.
Yes, mm-hmm.
And it was like a normal size DVD case, only perhaps about twice as thick as a normal one would be. And I thought, oh, if only they could release whole seasons in that sort of size of case. And this is even before I think Blu-rays were invented, and they go and do it, but they do it with And so, I mean, I think it barely reduces the shelf space it takes up these new rays by half the width of all the DVDs put together. But I think that a lot of it is also goes into this idea of how they're doing these limited releases of these. Because, I mean, all of us are on some sort of budget. And you ended up missing out on season 12, didn't you, Mark?
Yeah, yeah, I did.
Tom Baker's first season.
Yeah, and until they actually re-released that one. But I still missed out on, because of just the timing and the way things were at the time, the Trial of a Time Lord set and also Sylvester's last season.
And it is rather funny that all these people who've bought, you know, mass numbers of them in order to flog them for £100, £200 on eBay are now all being faced with possible financial ruin.
Values can go down as well as up, can't they?
I don't know, though, whether I'd... it depends, really. Let's say they say we're releasing this series next. Are they going to do the current format, the sort of the cardboardy blocky box, and then at perhaps a year down the line they're going to release the more normal DVD format? Or are they going to, on the day of release, you've got an option of choosing one or the other? Because like Dave says, I'd be reluctant to wait for a year until they release the new ones.
I should think it'll be the former. I shouldn't think they'll release them together because they want to maximise sales for the limited edition boxes. And so I think I think you'll be looking at least a year before the...
Remember when they used to issue, if you've ever collected a series of novels, and you're waiting for the next one to come out, there was a time they'd release it as a hardback, and it would possibly be quite a year before they'd release it as a cheap paperback, because they know that the people who are really waiting to read the next in the series aren't going to wait until the paperbacks come through. I'm not sure whether...
Well, I mean, that's right, because, I mean, there are people in Australia, for example, and I'm one of them sometimes, who won't even wait the 3 to 6 months it takes to get a local release down here, and we'll go and try and import a copy of the UK release from the UK, which is further restricting the supply for you guys. So people are absolutely going to go out and buy the more expensive one if it's the first one out. And let's face it, we probably all know fans who are going to go and buy both the special edition and the standard edition just so they've got a very complete set.
Mm.
I'm not sure whether I'd replace the original Blu-ray collection sets with new ones. I might do it after a while.
Well, if you do, I
was going to say, you can have my old one free, Mark. Because it's only be going to a charity shop, because I don't think if you try to sell it on Amazon or eBay, I suspect most people will sell now. They probably think that I was one of the scalpers who'd been trying to screw people over. Anyway, there we go. And so, in the hypothetical situation that we actually knew that Dave was joining us tonight, we did ask him if there was anything he'd like to do, and he suggested, having been told that unfortunately, no, we can't do the dinosaur invasion, and no, we can't do the Horns of Nymon, because we've already done them recently, I'm afraid, he settled for us doing a two-parter review of the First Doctor stories, The Rescue and The Romans. The Rescue, written by legendary writer David Whittaker, who I think at this point was the outgoing story editor, wasn't he?
Yes, is he the first of that Terence Dick's famous tradition where the outgoing story editor commissions himself to write the next story?
Yeah. Designed by Barry Newbery, 13 million viewers, set in 2493, I worked out. So, Dave, it was your idea, so fire away and tell us what you think about The Rescue.
So the reason why I picked The Rescue and The Romans is I think collectively they are not the most classical, the best, in inverted commas, Hartnell stories. I think there are better Hartnell stories, but in terms of just boiling down the quintessential Hartnell era, and particularly Hartnell the actor and the character and the First Doctor, I think these are just absolutely perfect. And in many ways, I think The Rescue is really important because it's not just the first story for Vicky, but it's kind of the first story for the rest of Doctor Who. Because season one, look, I love season one. There's some of my favourite stories are in season one. But there is a sense when you watch that season of they're still not quite sure what this show's doing.
No.
You know, a great example of that is the way the Doctor interacts with his companions, which is different to everything else in the series. But even, you know, there's that wonderful bit at the start of The Keys of Marinus where Arbitan says to them, I'm in desperate need of your help, and to save my planet, you know, I want to send you on this journey. And then it cuts to them walking back to the TARDIS going, I feel bad we couldn't help him, but oh well, whatever. And it's only because he then puts the Force Shield around the TARDIS and they go, well, we better go on this quest then. Whereas by the time you get to the rescue, you've got the Doctor's relationship with the companions has really settled down and become what it's going to be. And now you have this sense of they actually go to planets and go to times and they do right wrongs and they do get involved. And it's not just them trying to escape and get back to Earth. It actually is this ongoing saga. So I just think it really sort of sets up the rest of the series. But beyond that, it's just a really fun, tight little script. And look, I picked it, so you know I'm a fan. But what did you guys think?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right with everything you say about it being such a good story for William Hartnell. And it's a great introduction to a new character. Do you know what? When I watch this, I can't believe that it's only two episodes. In a way, it absolutely flies by as well. It's got so much packed in that it would make it, you know, it would fit in really well with the new era, wouldn't it?
In what sense?
Because it's sort of like 45, 50 minutes long.
Yes. I mean, in a sense, it's possibly a six-part story, isn't it? Split into two.
Well, it was produced in a six-part block, wasn't it, with the same production team?
Oh, was it? Right.
So, yeah. But William Hartnell's just this... I know what Dave is saying about it being like the quintessential William Hartnell performance as the Doctor. He's so mischievous. He's got that twinkly bit in his eye. And there's some lovely scenes with him. The scenes with Vicky, the first one early on where he meets them on the spaceship, and he immediately comes in and takes control of the situation and reassures everyone. And it's like, don't worry, I'm in command here. And then he goes in, he does his bit of detective work in Bennett's room and works out what's going on. And the absolute best bit of it, which I think is imperious, to be honest, is the bit where he sits himself down in the Dido temple. And, I mean, this is just, I think it's one of the finest Hartnell moments. And I think it sums up a lot of the character of the Doctor. And he sits there with his back to that door. And before you even realise that door's opened yourself, you know, he's saying, come in, come in.
I've been waiting for you.
Yes.
Yeah, I've got that in my notes too. I love that.
Come in, won't you? I've been waiting to talk to you.
And he doesn't turn round for ages, and he just stands there with his back to him, talking to him, saying that I know who you are. And but especially that image of him just sitting in that chair, just sort of thinking, and his eyes slightly narrowed, and it's as Kerquillian walks in, and it's just it really sums up the Doctor. And the way he's got his back to him, and he's showing no fear at all, and he even confronts him when he does confront him. He's got the guy's got his big gun, and it's like, what's the Doctor going to do? I mean, I don't think even he's realised what he's going to do at the time, and it's just
there's even some more physical stuff, isn't there, where the Doctor dives for that little spanner thing on the table, and they're wrestling to get it off each other. Even the Romans, he's doing a fair bit of fisticuffs, isn't he? I suppose it partly depends on at what point you twig that, spoilers, that Kerquillian and Bennett are the same person. I've got a strange idea that maybe I wasn't concentrating the first time I watched this, that I actually didn't realise until the reveal that Kerquillian was Bennett.
I first saw this when I was very, very young, so I didn't realise at all. I thought Kerquillian was just another Doctor Who monster, and so it was a surprise to me. But there's a lot of things there that Mark just mentioned I will pick up on in the conversation. But while we're talking about that confrontation scene, which is just amazing, there's one of Hartnell's best pieces of acting in there, which is he stood up to Bennett and he said, I know who you are, and I know that you're a murderer, and I know that you're insane, and he's really proud of himself and really chuffed. And then you can see the Doctor just twigs that, I was right, he is a crazy, insane serial killer. And I'm here all alone with him, and maybe I haven't thought this through. And it's all just played with looks, and it's really, really good.
It's clearly the main idea, I think, is not to produce a story. It's to introduce Vicky, isn't it? It's I mean, I think Vicky is amazing.
Yes.
When Peter Purvis joins. I don't think she's quite that good here, because a lot of the time she's...
Really?
In the first episode, she's sort of whinging a bit, isn't she? Oh, this is happening and this is happening and we crashed.
I think you're being a bit harsh on Vicky. I think she's got pretty good reason to be... she's got a lot to whinge about. I mean, Bennett is...
No, I'm not saying that she shouldn't whinge, but I'm saying the fact that they're putting a situation where she needs to whinge makes her a slightly weaker character. Whereas I think in the Romans, where she and the Doctor bugger off to Rome together, that's much better because she then gets to interact with him, doesn't she?
Yeah, look, I think you're right. Had her character been what she is here for the entirety of her run, it would be very different. But yeah, it is just her introduction. But I think that you're both right in both that it's a story that introduces a character, and that's the only reason for the story. But also what Mark said about this would fit in very well with the new series. Anytime one of these fans of the new series who don't like the classic series says, oh, in the classic series they never did emotion and characters just came and went and there's no, you know, real sort of effect on anybody and characters leave and nobody cares. Well, this story is all about that. It starts with the Doctor getting over the loss of his granddaughter, Susan, and how that's changing him and how that changes the dynamics of the TARDIS crew. And then there's a whole story about welcoming a new companion on board and giving her a backstory, and she has to talk about the death of her father. Yeah, that is doing what the new series does, but doing it 30 years earlier.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that it's almost quite a shock, the extent to which the Doctor changes here. He's gone from... I don't know whether it's because in the absence of Susan, he's no longer playing this sort of paternal or grand-paternal role of being the authority figure, but he wakes up. First of all, they present him to us snoozing in that Charles Eames chair. Presumably, he refers to this console as an exact replica of the one that Coco Chanel had in her Paris atelier. But he's... The second he's waking up, he pats Ian on the cheek. He's now more of a mischievous elfin sprite now. You know, sort of, isn't he? Sort of, keen to go out and see what's happening. Perhaps because he's now... His TARDIS crew are all the three adults that he doesn't need to... He can be more...
He's freed up of some of his responsibilities, isn't he?
Yes, I think that's it.
He's also becoming more relaxed with the idea of travelling with these two humans.
Yes, yeah.
But that moment just after he wakes up where Barbara says, oh, but Doctor, the trembling stopped. Oh, my dear, I'm so happy for you.
It's hilarious.
You can't imagine that happening, you know, in The Edge of Destruction, for example. That really is this sort of new lighter side of Hartnell, and it's so good.
Yeah. And he's fully into now his giggling phase, isn't he?
Or the bit where he interrupts Ian, where Ian's sort of doing the, well, you know, he is getting a bit old. Maybe he's getting a little... I can hear you out there.
It's nice where he absentmindedly calls for Susan.
Yes.
As he's leaving the TARDIS, but I think it's a pity that they don't... Given that Susan was the whole reason why Barbara and Ian are on the TARDIS, in the TARDIS in the first place, we don't really get to see any reaction to the Doctor having dumped her on Earth, do we? That doesn't seem to be... I mean, that really is perhaps the only...
Oh, there is that moment where Ian and Barbara talk about what Susan might be doing now, and they do reflect on it, but... You're right. It would be interesting if their part of that reflection had been...
Oh, yes, they do, don't they? Yes, that's right.
If he could kick his granddaughter off the ship that easily, what could he do to us?
But I think it makes sense to them. They knew that Susan wanted to stay there.
Yeah.
And that's what that is. That's why they're not upset. They're very happy for Susan. And they think that David's a good guy for her to be with. So there's none of that. The lovely thing about that is, well, this properly feels like just another episode in an ongoing serial. I know that we break it down into the stories that it was and the production blocks it was made in, sort of after the fact.
Mm.
But obviously, at this period, we're still going through, you know, it's still, every episode's just got its own title, hasn't it?
Yes.
It's not presented to the viewers so much as stories, is it? This story starts here, this story ends here, this story starts... you know, it's not like the Tom Baker era, for instance, where a lot of the stories you can watch in any old order and it kind of doesn't make too much difference. This actually feels much more part of a continual thing.
And it makes you sort of wonder what it must have been like to be a viewer back in 1963-64 and having this first change in companion, because we kind of look at it now as, oh yes, it's just another change of companion and Susan goes and Vicky comes in. But for the casual viewer, like just watching at the time, it must have been a pretty big deal.
Mm. Yeah, I know Maureen O'Brien said she wasn't quite prepared for the amount of sudden interest in her, because she'd been quite naive and suddenly like she was surrounded by the press.
I don't think she's ever quite got to terms with that, to be perfectly honest. I don't think she's ever quite felt relaxed in Doctor Who fandom.
No, there's a lovely bit where it's... I was reading the... what's the new Doctor Who magazine that's come out? It's not... it's an offshoot. It's one of the special editions, Chronicles.
Oh, no, okay.
Yeah, it's Chronicles, 1965. They take 1 year of Doctor Who and look at it in depth.
Oh, right, I've not read that yet.
And there's a bit in there where Maureen O'Brien's talking about her next job after being in Doctor Who was working as a drama teacher in a girls' school. And she said it was awful. She just had these, and to quote her, galumphing great girls pounding down the corridor after her, shouting, "Vicky, Vicky, Vicky," at her.
So what did you guys make of Kerquillian?
Oh, I think that costume's amazing. I love it. It's Daphne Dare, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. It also sort of undermines anyone who tries to say, oh, look at that, he's just clearly in a costume with a mask, isn't he?
Yeah.
Because that's the whole point of it.
Also in that Doctor Who Chronicles magazine, there's a piece by Alan Barnes, I think, on The Rescue. And you know the Sandy Beast in The Rescue?
Yeah.
He notes that there's something slightly Kerquillian about its features, and he says perhaps that's supposed to be where Bennett got the idea for becoming Kerquillian came from. And I was thinking, so as the writer not actually watched the episode, there's a huge great table in that temple with the face of Kerquillian on it. There's Kerquillian faces, I believe, like carved elsewhere. The Doctor even says that those are ceremonial robes and things that Bennett's picked up.
The Doctor even finds the chest of clothes that he got the costume from.
Yeah, I know. It's just a really bizarre piece. I thought, well, I was reading it this afternoon. I was thinking, no, I don't think Bennett was inspired by the Sandy Beast at all.
No, but it is clever that he's picked up that the design of Kerquillian and the Sandy Beast are similar. So there is this sort of sense of an actual alien culture with it. You know, this is what animals look like on that planet. It's quite a clever piece of design.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it came out at the beginning of this year, didn't it? Around about January, this Chronicles one.
Yeah, it went out of stock quite quickly, but I believe it's back in stock now if anyone's interested in purchasing it. But yeah, it's great. And what did you think of Kerquillian?
Well, just talking about the Sandy Beast, I referred to Ian and Barbara earlier. I think perhaps we should refer to her now as Barbara the Pet Killer.
Yes, I do like the line when Vicky is talking to the Doctor about Barbara, and he says, well, I would have done the same thing. Oh, you haven't got that sort of face that kills things. And Barbara has, I suppose. to which Vicky just sort of looks at him and goes, meh.
The Kerquillian mask, quoting from the DWM special here, the Kerquillian mask worn by Bennett was inspired by the close-up photo of the features of a fly. Yes, it does rather, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It seems David Whittaker intended to present Bennett as a Phantom of the Opera type, hiding imagined scars behind a mask, but Christopher Barry viewed him as a Jekyll and Hyde character and described him as such to, oh, Bernard Archard, the actor to whom he first offered the part. That was Lawrence Scarman, wasn't it? No, Marcus Scarman.
Yeah. And also off the John Le Mesurier was considered for the part as well.
I couldn't imagine that at all.
No.
He'd sort of slide open the door of Vicky's spaceship, stand over and menacing over and said, would you mind terribly not stepping out of the spaceship, please, my dear? Ray Barrett, who played Bennett, was an Aussie.
And he's really good.
Yes, he is.
He is, isn't he?
One of my favourite little pieces from him is the bit where Vicky reveals that Barbara's actually been saved and all the rest of it. And Barbara starts going on about how, well, Kerquillian does make all these mistakes and he's pretty rotten and, you know, we should try and trap Kerquillian. And Although we're not meant to know at this stage that Bennett is Kaquillian, if you watch it with that knowledge, you can see Bennett's getting more and more annoyed that Barbara is saying how absolutely terrible he is as a monster.
Yeah, I have to say this is an incredibly rewarding story once you know what's going on. Some stories are spoiled by the revelation. You know, and you go back and you think, I wish I didn't know it was them. But I think you actually get a lot more out of this story knowing Bennett is Kaquillian, because it's so dark. You suddenly realise how incredibly dark the story is. His coercive behaviour with Vicky is just appalling.
Yeah, and there's a really good bit there where Vicky's telling, I think it's Ian and Barbara, you know, it's really important when we go back to Earth and we tell them what the Dido people did to us and we make sure we tell our story. And she's clearly got that from Bennett. And then in the next episode, or maybe later that episode, Bennett's saying to the doctor, I manipulated Vicky so that she would think this and she'll be a witness for me. And she's totally invested in the lies that Bennett's told her.
It's a pity that he has such a slightly underwhelmingly quick death, Bennett, at the end, where they just, those two guys who don't say anything advance towards him, he falls off the cliff at the end.
Yeah, they basically escort him off a cliff, don't they?
Yeah, it is a little bit weak, but I guess what Whittaker's going for there is that the real climax of the episode is the Doctor's confrontation, and after that, everything else is just tying the knots together. But it's kind of like the cliffhanger at the end of part one. Look, it's a nice little set piece, but it actually makes no sense in the story. Why do the Dido people just have this random sword trap that, you know, is in the middle of nowhere? And it clearly exists because they need to have a cliffhanger, and that's the only reason. And that is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, and it's established later on that the Sandy Beast is a vegetarian.
Yes, so that's right. They weren't in that much danger anyway.
Yeah, no, nothing would have happened. So it was just, yeah.
I was watching last night on some Netflix somewhere, one of these, you know, thousands of US TV dramas that's, you know, a courtroom set. And the lawyer's interviewing a witness, a witness to a murder. And the guy who's the witness is like one of these Just Eat people, you know, someone who you see going around on a bike with a pack on their back, and they're delivering takeaway meals to houses. And he said, so can you remember where you were standing? Oh, yes, I was standing outside number 24. I'd just delivered a vegan meal to them. And the lawyer says in surprise, a vegan meal? You can remember it that well, can you? And he says, yes, we always remember the low tippers. Which I thought was quite funny.
I mean, Bennett is a monster. He's a terrible, terrible person. We don't know anything about the murder on the spaceship at all. We don't know what happened there, but that's not the point. The fact is that he then, as the doctor says, you destroyed a whole planet to save your own skin. You're insane.
Yes.
He really is one of the most evil people that you could meet in Doctor Who, really, isn't he? And like I say, his manipulation and coercive control over Vicky is absolute. I don't know. Is he a psychopath? I guess he would be. I don't know.
Kaquillian in the closing credits of the first episode is cast as Sidney Wilson. Which apparently is just a joke on Sidney Newman and Rodney Wilson, the head of drama and head of serials at the BBC.
That's really interesting, because we kind of think of J&T as inventing the idea of giving people pseudonyms in the credits to not blow the surprise, you know, like leader and lieutenant instead of cyber leader and all the master's joke things. But I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
I have to say, there's one bizarre line in this story. They're in this wrecked spaceship. And Vicky says to, I'll get some food. Will you lay the table, Barbara?
Well, they're from Britain, aren't they? So they're terribly civilised.
Yeah, where are your napkin rings, Vicky?
On that note, though, the model work and the sets for the spaceship are actually very good. And I really like that they've tried to make the sets look like they're on an angle, because to actually match the model work, which is something a lot of the 60s Who doesn't quite get right, matching sets and models and design. But here it's all very, very cleverly done.
Yeah, the sets on this are great. The spaceship's fantastic. I love the, it's very simply done, but as the Dido temple as well. It has a brilliant atmosphere to it.
It looks so vast. Like, for something filmed in a studio in 1964, it's so vast.
Yeah, it's just pretty much black drapes and low lighting, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's very effective.
If any of you faithful listeners follow what used to be my blog, which I've got out of the habit of completing a long time ago, you'll see that I was following the First Doctor's era, story by story, because I decided that a First Doctor's character arc can be determined by the different modes of address he uses when he's talking to Ian. So right at the beginning, he's saying, could you tell me what you're doing in my junkyard, young man? And at the end, he's calling him Ian. In fact, at the end of the chase, he even says, I could kiss you, Ian, doesn't he? let's see. On the very first story, which is obviously Unearthly Child, it doesn't help much because he calls him young man twice and Chesterton once. So that doesn't tell us much. If we go to The Daleks, which is the second story, the Doctor addresses Ian in 20 different ways. He calls him young man four times, my boy once, dear boy twice, my dear boy once, and my dear young man once. And that's even before we get to the variations on his surname, where we get 7 Chestertons, 2 Chestermans, 1 Chesterfield, and a chair. as Ian runs off with the Doctor. And so, what's happened by the time we reach the rescue, where the Doctor is so much more affectionate towards Ian and Barbara? He calls him Chesterton 6 times, my boy 5 times, dear boy once, my dear boy 3 times, my dear fellow twice, my dear Chesterton once, and we even get it in calling him a rare Ian once in this story. So keep on the edge of your seats, listeners, for when I tell you what happens during the next story we're going to be covering. Have we finished with the rescue, by the way?
The final point I make, I think, is just again about the characterisation. I think that, although I see what you were saying, Doc, about Vicky whinging a lot and moaning a lot, I actually think she's done in a quite convincing way. And her little rant to Barbara about, you know, she doesn't need anybody, she's been alone, she's tough, all the rest of it, that feels so much more like a real teenager than anything that Susan ever did. And I really like that. But you're right, it couldn't have continued. But I just wanted to note that because this is the 1960s, for all of the stuff that Vicky does and the role that Barbara and Ian play, it is the Doctor who gets to be the hero, and it's the Doctor who solves the problem. And I just think that's something that some later stories, even in the 80s, let alone the new series, do kind of forget to make the Doctor the hero. And I just think it's a really good story for the Doctor to solve the problem, to be the mentor, and to be the hero.
Yeah, 100%.
That blog, by the way, was docwhom, docwhom.wordpress.com, which links in the show notes, of course, which can be found on our podcast blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com.
Yes, I believe you only got as far as the massacre, didn't you?
Yeah.
Come on, Doc, the end's in sight by the massacre. You can't stop now.
Well, the problem is, of course, that Ian's no longer with us by this stage. So I've had to try and find a way of how he's talking to Ben and Stephen. It's not really as interesting.
No, that's true.
And then, of course, the horrifying ending to the story, which is the TARDIS toppling over a cliff.
Literal cliffhanger.
Yeah, that's almost as bad as the most scary thing there is in Doctor Who, which is them walking out of the TARDIS and just wandering off to explore an alien planet without locking the door behind them. But a TARDIS toppling over a cliff. Right, before we get on to the next story, are you hungry, guys? Should we order something in to eat?
Oh, yes, please.
Hello, Marmoset Pizzas? Yes, can I order one of your pizzas, please? Yes, we'll have a large deep pan, please. And we'll have your Roman pizza. So that has breast of peacock, isn't it? Okay. What sort of sauce do you want, boys? Do you want tomato sauce?
No, can we have orange and juniper, please?
Yeah, orange and juniper, please. Any extra toppings?
Lark's tongues?
Oh, yes, lark's tongues, please.
And can we have some baked pomegranates, please?
And we'll have baked pomegranates, please. And can you let us have a little tub of ants' eggs in hibiscus honey, please? Thank you. Anyway, The Romans was the next story, written by Dennis Spooner, who's the incoming script editor for the series. I think for this run of Doctor Who, that's sort of the closest, script editor is the closest you really get to the idea of having a showrunner, isn't it? It's clearly, there isn't the same sense of, you know, they're trying to produce an arc as they do nowadays, or the same sense of stylistic control that JNT had. Anyone like to try and start us on The Romans?
Mark, why don't you go?
Okay, yeah. Well, it's pretty much, as we said before, this is just another continuation of William Hartnell's fantastic performance, isn't it?
Mm,
yes.
And because we've got the four episodes here, we get them split up into two groups at the start, and they're absolutely divine, both groups, Ian and Barbara, together by this point. Just so watchable, and the natural on-screen chemistries, it's just wonderful to watch. And the same with William Hartnell and Maureen O'Brien as well. I love it. There's another piece in that Chronicles article where Maureen O'Brien says, I liked William Hartnell a lot. I loved him, actually. And there does seem real affection there. I mean, I know they're actors, but they, you know, there's something there that you just don't seem to get with the Doctor and Susan.
No, possibly because there's not that parental idea there.
And I think because he's taking her on an adventure, and so she's never been anywhere before, so suddenly he's got like, oh, I can show you this, why don't we go and do this? And, you know, you can see him delighting in it.
Yes, I have a theory that all the best Doctor Companion teams are actually that dynamic where the companion desperately wants to just explore the universe and be shown time and space, and the Doctor is really enjoying showing them time and space. And whether it's the Fourth Doctor and Adric, or Capaldi and Bill, I think that all those sort of dynamics are really helped by that. And it's really interesting that the first shot we see of Vicky in this story is her running out ahead of Barbara to the market. I want to see it, I want to do stuff. And that just sets the whole tone for Vicky, I think.
Yeah, it's great. Just the whole start, I mean, William Hartnell's just fantastic from the start. That whole bit with the, when they sat around the dinner table and discussing the menu. It's because this really plays to William Hartnell's strengths and his past experience in comedy, just the way he's sort of going, what was next? Oh, exquisite, and oh, divine, and stuff. And then ants' eggs. It's just lovely.
His comic timing in this is absolutely wonderful. Then there's the exchange a little bit later on where he says, oh, Chesterfield, Chesterton. Oh, Barbara wants you.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, that's, yes. Made me absolutely guffaw.
Oh, what's the other one? He's in the apoditarium. The apoddy what? The apoditarium. It is just surprising, isn't it? He's got that comic timing, considering that you do still see him, not exactly fluffing lines by this stage, but still, I mean, I think it's still at the point where you can't really tell. It could be, you know, something every actor is doing because they can't afford to reshoot the scene. At this point, it's just a normal stumbling over lines.
Mm. Yes, and you get so many of them, and lots of lovely little asides. You know, I always laugh out loud. I'm not quite sure why, but just his delivery of, oh, there's our hissing friend again.
Yes, yeah, I know. Yeah, must you hiss my name from all corners? And so yeah, it's just, yeah, it's great. It's kind of almost like he knows he's in a TV show. You know, it's like it's almost breaks the fourth wall, but not quite. And his, she keeps an eye on all the liars. Which is,
yes,
yeah.
Which is just after an old man is violently murdered with some nice jaunty music.
Yeah. His fight scene in this is great as well. And he's so cross when Vicky comes in and interrupts. It's like, I just softened him up for the old one too. And going about the gentle art of fisticuffs.
Yes, he is an absolute delight in this. And anybody who says that the First Doctor was just a grumpy, crotchety old man.
Mm.
And yeah, look, he absolutely had that part of his persona, and that's important. But you watch these stories, and particularly the Romans, he is a lovely, as my podcasting colleague Rob says, he's a Yoda-like figure.
Yes. Yeah, this whole story is very much... I think somebody on Twitter, there was a little thing going on saying, name 10 episodes of Doctor Who, or name 10 Doctor Who stories that make you happy. And so it wasn't asking for the best ones or anything like that, just ones that you put on, you smile. And the Romans was in there for me. Because it's just a pleasure to watch from start to end, despite the fact that, you know, characters are sold into slavery, and, you know, again, it's got quite dark elements. It's
the slavery thing is very dark, isn't it? It's I was trying to work out whether it really is recognizing that enough. I mean, when they shove Barbara into the cage and say, "I'll find you something to wear that's you know, more suitable," that's effectively, we won't actually say it out loud. But we effectively know what was going to happen to her. But of course, with a children's story, they can't go into that, can they?
So that's a really interesting point. It's one that I made a note of. I think that it does it better here than it does it in some other stories. And I think, for example, of The Mythmakers, which is a very similar story in tone.
Yeah.
And look, I really enjoy The Mythmakers. It's a really fun story. But that is three episodes of kind of levity, and even the sword fights are sort of done as like a mockery of a sort of a sword fight, and sort of setting up the cliches. And it's all very fun until you get about 5 minutes into part four, where it just becomes this dark, grim slaughter of all the characters that you've got to love. And it really is quite a jarring change of tone. Whereas this one, I think, does ease between that sort of stuff. You get some very fun scenes, and then it pulls back and you get some darker scenes, and certainly Barbara's reaction to a lot of things, you know, when she has that bit where she says, "I'm a history teacher, I know what happens to Roman slaves," and when you see the people locked in the jails, and you know what's going to happen to them, and you see the lions, and they talk about the gladiators, it's all there. But I think that it's balanced in with the fun in just enough way that it's not ignored, but it's not jarring to switch between them.
No, I mean, so obviously some of the Me Too stuff with Nero is obviously, I mean, that's just the tone from the Carry On films and the Frankie Howard stuff, isn't it? And that's all just part of that time. I mean, and to be fair, I think there's the bit where Barbara's introduced as the new maid, and you can see her Nero sort of walking around, looking up and down, going, "Rrr." And even Barbara looks amused at that point.
It's not just a very 1960s sort of comedy, but it's a very 1960s, 1970s take on Rome. If you look at any sort of drama or comedy that's set in this sort of time, that's kind of how Rome and Roman emperors were portrayed. And I look, for example, at the wonderful performance that Roy Kinnear does when he turns up in the Roman episode of The Goodies, where he just takes this all to a whole new level. And in fact, it was so sexually suggestive that about 10 minutes of that was cut out of the broadcast in Australia because we're very sensitive here.
Who's he playing?
I think he's playing Nero. He's certainly playing one of the Roman emperors. But that's the one where Roy Kinnear's on this bit of fruit and then hands over the empire to Tim.
This reminds me, I've just recently moved. I really do need to get my... I've just set up my television, so I need to get my box set out that I got for Christmas that I started on.
Oh, which one? Oh, the goodies, yes.
Yes, the goodies. And then, I shall follow it up with the... what's it called? Dave?
The Goodies Pirate Podcast.
The Goodies Pirate Podcast, yeah.
No, I hope you do. But can we continue talking about Nero? I think that...
Yes.
No,
we can certainly... Well, we're going to.
I will continue saying that every time everyone starts something with a "can we," as if you're seriously asking. Because what we're all really... Hayden always does it. What he's really saying is, "Shut up, I want to continue talking about this."
Well, I will switch and do my Hitchhiker's Philosopher and say, "I demand we now talk about Nero." And I think that, look, we can certainly talk about the character and the actor, and there's a lot of fun to happen there, but... Again, it is that very sort of 1960s view of Rome, which is the Rome you think of rather than the Rome that is historically accurate.
Yes.
Nero died at the age of 30, and he was about 26 at the time that this was set. The actor, Derek Francis, is 42 at the time, whereas his wife, Poppaea, was 34, so I think she's about a lot more accurate. And most of the names, like Lacusta and the like, are all accurate, but it is very a schoolboy's book of Rome.
Yes, yeah.
But, you know, given that, what did we think of Derek Francis?
Well, given that Bob Holmes sent Terence Dix out to get the Bumper Schoolboy's Book of Lighthouses in order to drive Fangrock, it probably gives you an idea of what sort of sources they are using. I was jokingly thinking that, I wonder if, what's the guy who plays Nero called?
Derek Francis.
Yeah. I was jokingly wondering, whether when he was doing Quo Vadis, Peter Ustinov had seen this guy playing Nero in Doctor Who. But only because one is glorious technical and the other is this BBC black and white. And actually, this is about, what's this, 1965, is it?
Yes.
So this is about 14 years after Quo Vadis. So I think he's clearly basing his portrayal of Nero on Peter Ustinov in Quo Vadis, which is, he's almost stealing every scene, isn't he? Well, it's things where he hands Tigellinus the cup of wine that's poisoned, and when he falls over, he just gives him a funny look, stabs the soldier for not fighting hard enough, and lines like, I do think it's funny where the Doctor does the whole Emperor's New Clothes thing with it, and with his playing the lyre. And you expect Nero to be saying things like, oh, isn't it wonderful? But he still says, oh, he's all right, but he's not that good. Which I think is really, really funny.
That scene is absolutely brilliant. And not just the way that Hartnell does it, but my favourite part is where Hartnell sort of looks like he's finished. There's that nervous applause, and then he goes in for that one last flourish. But yeah, look, Nero gets some wonderful lines and some wonderful moments. One of the subtle ones that I really like is after Vicky has tried to poison him, and the Doctor comes out and, you know, don't drink the wine. And Nero's got his arm around Vicky as he says, if only I could land my hands on whoever was responsible.
Yes, yeah, I took a note of that as well.
But what is interesting is that although some of the Roman stuff is accurate and some of it's a little bit schoolboyish, watching it, I really did appreciate how much we're still in that very Sidney Newman concept of the show having to be educational. And there's lots of little moments like the Doctor's talking about, oh, the Romans didn't have pipes, they had aqueducts. And no, it's not called London, it's Londinium. And it almost is a little bit jarring watching it now, but you totally get that's what the series was actually meant to be about in that time.
Yeah, it really makes you mourn the passing of the historicals, doesn't it, I think.
It's also interesting that if this was done today, there would be a lot more exposition of the Doctor to the companions on behalf of the audience about, well, don't forget we're in Rome and this happens and this happens. Whereas in the 60s, you see there's a lot more assumed knowledge of the audience. And there's this assumption that, you know, anybody who's gone to a British school in the 1960s has done some basic Roman history and doesn't need to get all the facts exposited to them.
Yeah, I think Ryan would be very busy saying, look, it's a Roman. And yeah, so he's saying, yes, we did them at school. Do you remember? They said that this, and
that's
this.
That's right.
And that Nero reigned from such and such to such and such. See, I remember that.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, or even that the whole joke that you mentioned, Doc, about the apodeterium. I'm sure that if that was done in Tubnell's era, somebody would have said, it means undressing room.
Oh, yes, I remember that from my Latin class.
It is quite strange, isn't it? They start this, we very much get linear stories from Doctor Who. They start this, the TARDIS topples over the cliff, and then we go straight into them having been already swanning around this deserted villa for a month, feasting themselves. That's a bit of a new thing.
Yeah, can I just say, I love that opening shot of the TARDIS on its side, all overgrown with vines and stuff. It's brilliant.
Yeah. I wonder if William Russell's audition for Ben-Hur was really in preparation for being able to do this role.
Yeah, I wondered that.
I don't think it's funny when he's rowing as a galley slave, and you can see the absolute depths of degradation to which Ian has been reduced, in that he now has the very faintest trace of a 5 o'clock shadow. I don't know how long he's been sitting on that rowing bench, but clearly they, at some point, they stop rowing everyone and queue for the barber.
I do like those opening scenes in the villa. I do wonder whether this actually happens to them quite a bit, and they have lots of occasions where they arrive somewhere in time and space and it's all very friendly and they just sit around and eat crepes. But we don't see that because that wouldn't be a very exciting adventure. But also, it again occurs to me, and I'm contrasting this story with the new series quite a bit, and I've got at least one more to go, but this is the stuff that, you know, people, you hear occasionally people say, oh, well, you know, you could have done the whole first episode as a pre-credits trailer now. And yeah, sure, you could. But you would miss out on stuff like the TARDIS crew sitting around just eating dinner together and being incredibly funny and lovely.
Yeah, we've lost a certain slowness to life in general, haven't we, in the modern age? Mm. And I think that's one of the reassuring and sort of cosy things about watching, for me, for watching old things like Doctor Who. It is slower, and I like that. And I like the fact that it gives scenes time to breathe, and it lets you have these wonderful scenes with them just messing about and, you know, joking about, oh yeah, there's some ice in the fridge and stuff like that. And it's just, I mean, it's given so much fuel to Ian and Barbara Shippers over the decades.
I mean, the erotic back and forth between Barbara and Ian really, sorry, Barbara the pet killer and Ian really changes this, isn't it? Don't you think he looks really different once she gives him the new hairstyle?
Yes.
You know, she takes the side parting out of his hair. But that the ice in the fridge, when he does that joke back at her at the very end, they almost start wrestling, don't they?
Yes.
By that fountain, which I thought was quite...
Yeah.
I had to lie down with an ice pack on my head when I saw that.
It's interesting. I was watching it with today's sensibilities, and there are two ways you can look at that scene, and if they're not a couple, that's an incredibly Me Too, unfortunate scene. So you have to kind of assume they are a couple, because then it sort of becomes an affectionate play.
Yeah.
Yeah, there has to be affection there, because Ian's character throughout this entire story, once they've been kidnapped, well, I mean, they're basically a couple torn apart, aren't they?
Yeah.
That scene where Barbara's left still chained up with the other slaves and Ian's taken away is kind of horrific. And you know, like you said before, her awareness of what goes on in Rome, suddenly she knows she's there by herself. And, you know, her one comfort, so to speak, has just been torn away from her. And then Ian spends the rest of the series, and he's not talking about trying to find the Doctor and Vicky, is he? He's saying, I must find Barbara. What's happened to Barbara? I must find Barbara. Yeah.
I was about to make that exact point, and their only concern about finding the Doctor again is they're just worried he's going to get bored and leave in the TARDIS and leave them in ancient Rome.
Mm.
Other than that, all the time they're talking about finding each other, and part of the big resolution of the story is actually the moment where Tavius introduces Ian and Barbara back to each other. Like that's part of the climax of the story.
Yeah, and there's that bit when just before the fight in front of Nero, and Ian and Barbara suddenly set eyes on each other again and show each other's name. And you know that you think at that moment, well, I mean, he does. You know that Ian is going to win that fight somehow. And he does initially, but it's the fact he doesn't deliver the killing blow gives Delos the chance to come back. But yeah, Ian's a proper romantic hero in this, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's funny because I absolutely adore Ian and Barbara now, but when I was younger, I used to read DWM, I used to look at the old black and white photos of the Doctor with his first companions, Ian and Barbara. I used to think, oh man, they're so old and they're school teachers.
Yeah.
God, that must have been so boring. Who'd want to travel with two old school teachers?
If you do watch it, maybe if a teenager's watching this now, they would think that. But as you're old, you watch it back this sort of era. And it's very much not that at all, is it? I mean, I think you even think that that's the era, don't you? Poor Jackie Hill, she would have been playing that role where, you know, the woman is just hanging around making a cup of tea with nothing to do. But she's actually, she's a brilliant character, Barbara, isn't she? Mm. She's, I mean, I keep mentioning that bit in the, what follows the Daleks?
Edge of Destruction.
Edge of Destruction, where she really turns on the Doctor. He says, you stupid, stupid old man. And that, wow, no one ever talks to the Doctor like that. Okay, Clara does it. She says she might keep slapping him across the face. But it's not quite as dramatic.
Or charming, no.
No.
For what reason?
Blackmail, that's why. You tried to force me to return you to England.
Oh, don't be so stupid.
I know it, I'm sure of it.
How dare you? Do you realise, you stupid old man, that you'd have died in the Cave of Skulls if Ian hadn't made fire for you? And what about what we went through against the Daleks? Not just for us, but for you and Susan too. And all because you tricked us into going down to the city.
But I...
Accuse us? You ought to go down on your hands and knees and thank us. But gratitude's the last thing you'll ever have, or any sort of common sense either.
But possibly she's removed now from... A bit like the way the Doctor's freed from his grandfatherly duties. She's freed from her sort of maternal duties. Because a lot of the time was, wasn't it? Oh, don't worry, you go and save the day, Dr. and Ian. I'll sit here and bathe Susan's ankle that she's just sprained by tripping over a piece of ground. I think she's brilliant.
And she gets some really nice moments here. I mean, when she first meets Tavius, after he's bid 7,000 vamps to buy her, or whatever it is. And she says, I am going to escape. I'm going to let you know I am going to escape. And she stands up to Nero and, you know, she is terrified by the circumstance that she is in. And she knows how bad things are for a slave in Rome. But she's still a very determined person.
Yeah, she's absolutely fantastic.
It's quite clearly a deliberate comedy, this, isn't it? I mean, do they do, perhaps... I know City of Death is more has comedic moments rather than the fact it's a comedy, but did they ever do an outright comedy again?
Oh, the Mythmakers and the Gunfighters would be the other two. But I have described the Romans as the second wittiest script in Doctor Who, and I think that that is true.
What, after Time Flight, you mean?
I was going to say City of Death, but I guess you're right. Third wittiest story.
Yes, I've forgotten the Gunfighters. Is the Mythmakers that farcical?
Yes, it's funny.
Yeah, I think any story that has the episode title Small Profit, Quick Return, and in the first...
yes.
In the first 5 minutes, the Doctor has the line to the Greek, you've killed that man. Yes, Lord, but in your name.
It's, I think it's one of Al Noh's favourites, the Mythmakers. I think I remember commenting at a time when we reviewed it years ago, that it reminded me a bit of... And we'd only seen the recon. It reminded me a bit of a sort of a comedy of manners, set in some kind of Edwardian drawing room. Not entirely like something like The Importance of Being Earnest, but that sort of thing, rather than, you know, an ancient history adventure.
So a couple of points I just wanted to make. The first is just around the character of Delios, who I think is a very interesting and well-realised character. And this conversation where they have to fight in the gladiatorial arena, and he turns to Ian and he just says, I'm going to fight you, Ian. I just thought it was a very real moment, because this guy is a person from 65, 64 BC Rome.
Mm.
And that's how he would react. And there's none of this sort of... And yes, in the end, he can't bring himself to kill his friend, and that's really good. But it does feel more real because of that. And also, the characters like Delios mean that we not only split the TARDIS crew into two at the start, but we then split it into three. And it's really interesting how the 60s TARDIS crew, over the course of a four-episode story, or even two parts in The Rescue, they really can split into two and three different plot streams and all carry their own plot streams in a way that the Davison crew struggles to do and the Chibnall crew, I think, really struggle to do.
I wonder if in the same way that What's-His-Name's portrayal of Nero is based on Peter Ustinov in... Quo Vadis. I wonder whether that bit about them having to kill one another so that one can survive is based on the end of Spartacus. What was that, Spartacus? 1960s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
And the Victus, that was the days when... You know this thing that some people will occasionally say is, oh, isn't it awful how Hollywood always chooses Brits to play the real nasty baddies?
Yes.
I've always felt that it was a matter of pride. Because if you've seen Spartacus, nearly all of the Romans are played by classical British actors like Olivier and Peter Ustinov and Charles Laughton. The glorious, proper acting voices, what I'd call it, to go back to this thing. Actually, if you're going to say, instead of I'm having this, yes, it may, and maybe Jodie would say that sort of thing with her... Yorkshire sentimentality. Yes, it may sound authentic working class or something, but you've just got rid of two consonants, which means that you've almost removed any way that by saying that word that you can actually put any dramatic or histrionic force on it. I say people must be bored of me saying this by now, but I'm sure that gradually, a bit like... how we've gradually, by blocking and muting people, reduced our diddly-dum Twitter account feed to something quite civilised and free of haters. I imagine that by now, anyone from our audience who doesn't like me banging on about this will long ago have unsubscribed from the diddly-dum podcast. This is a real lesson for Davis, isn't it? He actually realises quite how chaotically all over the place the Tiddly Dub podcast is.
I'm shocked. I thought this was a professionally run, smooth operation. So I demand that we talk about Tavius. And
Is he the bald guy who turns out to be a Christian?
That's right. So this is another example of, I think, where Doctor Who is at its best in any era. You can judge it by the quality of the minor characters and the guest characters. Bennett in The Rescue is a really good example of this. Nero, obviously, we've spoken about. But Tavius is a more minor character who is really, really interesting because we first meet him and he's buying Barbara. Like, he's buying slaves, which signals him as being a bad person. And then he's sort of very polite to Barbara and he's sort of like, well, he's a nice slave buyer, I guess. And then he deals with the Doctor, and then he's the hissing person. And then you realise that he's actually part of some sort of ongoing plot that Maximus Battalion is meant to be part of. And it all sort of goes through, and then finally he's the person who reunites Ian and Barbara and sets them free. And all the while you're sort of going, I wonder what this guy's deal is and what his motivation is. Now, I can remember the first time I ever saw the Romans was about 1990 at a local Doctor Who club meeting where they would show, you know, very bad quality multi-generational VHS dubs of old stories and sometimes new stories because, you know, we were years behind the UK getting the McCoy era. So, you know, would sort of shift between seeing Greatest Show in the Galaxy for the first time and the Romans for the first time. But I can remember not only everybody in that room being entranced by this story and genuinely finding it funny and involving, but that scene where Tavius pulls out the cross as he's watching Rome burn, I can actually remember the audience drawing breath and gasping as they've realised what this is saying and actually how, you know, for Doctor Who, it's actually quite a profound moral point that they're making there.
Yeah, that did. Actually, funny enough, this was one of the subjects that I was going to bring this up because I wasn't quite entirely sure. Don't remember noticing it on the first time I watched it through, and I was going to ask what was the significance of that particularly, if that's not a stupid question. Is it just simply that
one of the cross?
Because of the way they focus and they zoom in on it.
Well, because at this stage, Christianity was just a cult coming out of Judea, and it was, I think by this stage, it had been banned by the Romans, if not, it certainly was close to. And it was just at that stage where Christianity was very, very slowly starting to permeate into Roman society. And I think what they're trying to do, or what the writer's trying to do, is link that sort of driving force of Enlightenment Christianity with people like Wilberforce, who went on and ended the slave trade, and sort of saying, well, as Christianity takes a hold in Rome, all these sort of evils that we're seeing, including from Tavius, are starting to be remedied. And indeed, the fact that Tavius's big moment is to free two slaves.
Yeah.
I think it's drawing a bit of a parallel there, which would seem perhaps a little bit trite if we did it in 2021, but for 1965, it sort of feels very comfortable British tea time viewing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I wonder if it's also that, going back to what we were saying, like, this is a very 60s view of ancient Rome, that again, things like Spartacus and that, the baddies are the Romans and the goodies are invariably either the Christians or they're effectively a cipher for Christianity.
Yeah. That is true as well.
And maybe this links back to things like Quo Vadis, which is very much, it's Nero throwing all the Christians to the lions in the arena. In fact, there's a wonderful scene where, is it Finlay Curry? Curry plays St. Peter, who ends up getting crucified. This very famous classical British actor who's ends up naked except for a loincloth and a very long white beard, being crucified upside down on a shoreline, which is... If there's no other reason to watch Quo Vadis than Peter Ustinov is to watch that. There's also a great performance from a guy called... this is going off subject of a guy called Leo Genn, who's very much this smooth spin doctor who spends the whole show mocking Nero's artistic pretensions, but doing it in such a way that Nero thinks that he's praising him. Have a go at watching it if you can. It's quite fun.
If we're talking about history and depictions of history, I think we probably have to talk about that scene in part four where the Doctor inspires the Great Fire of Rome. And a number of fans, and I think they're right, have kind of pointed this out as being the turning point for Doctor Who and for the historicals, because this is where, either because of the change in the production team or actually a change in the character, we go from the idea of you can't change history to actually they can get involved in history. And I quite like the idea that the Doctor genuinely believes, because he was taught on Gallifrey that no, history is locked down, you can't change history. And then when he accidentally inspires Nero to set the Great Fire, he's like, ooh, I can change history. This could be quite fun. And that's why he sort of gets quite excited and starts giggling a bit.
Yeah, that's a great performance at the end again by him, isn't it? And that bit where Vicky's leading him away. And you can see exactly that going through his mind as he's going, no, it wasn't me. How can you say it was me? And he seems quite flustered and embarrassed.
And Nero, I'll have you both killed over and over again.
Do you two think, you know his great line in the Aztecs, you can't change history, not one, which I think is one of Bill Hartnell's best lines, the way he delivers it. Have you always thought that that's him saying you can't change history, i.e., you know, even if you attempt to do it, history will fight back and it'll turn out, you know, that you can't change it at all? Or do you think it means you can't change history as in it is ethically wrong to change history? You can't do that as in you don't have the ability to do that? Or do you think it's you can't do things like that because it's wrong to do it?
I don't know what you and Mark think, but I've always taken it as being it was a moral thing, that it is immoral and dangerous to change history. And that's why I think that when he does it here and it all kind of works out and it's kind of fun for him, that's why he goes, actually, maybe I've been a bit over the top with this and I can have a bit more fun with this history thing.
Yes. Actually, that does make sense, doesn't it? Because if in the Aztecs, he's seeing it quite indignantly, isn't it?
But you can't rewrite history. Not one line.
Whereas if he was teaching them that there's no point trying to do it, you can't fight against history, he'd be saying it more sort of wistfully and resignedly. Well, you can't change history, you know.
Yeah, I'd think it's more of a danger thing.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, which is ignored most of the time anyway, because as far as the Time Lord has happened, if time's just already from start to finish is already there and it's one big straight line that they can travel up and down anyway, then he shouldn't even be stopping the Daleks invading planets or anything.
Yes, exactly.
We view history as being our personal history at this point on the planet Earth, but for the Doctor, every, you know, when he goes to 2394 and the rescue, that's somebody's history.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't just go, sorry, we're going to have to leave Vicky to die on this planet.
Yes, but I mean, practically the show would be a very difficult show if they...
Oh, yeah.
You know, if every time they went somebody, there was a Sound of Thunder-style change of history.
Well, that's a problem in a way, isn't it? Because if you view in Doctor Who Universe that you could travel a billion years backwards or a billion years forwards, that means that all of time is available to you at any one point, which means that anything you do at any point, wherever you are, you're changing someone's history, aren't you? If I take this this pencil and snap it, then it means that maybe someone who's a great writer, maybe Mark, who turns out to be a great writer, and
I shouldn't think so.
Tomorrow he would have written some kind of wonderful poem with this pencil. If I snap that pencil now, I'm stopping from doing it.
Now you've broken the museum pencil.
In fact, that's such a horrific idea that pass me that pencil, will you, Mark?
Oh, no. Oh, it's my best one. I mean, to be honest, you have to ignore that in a way, don't you?
Yes,
because otherwise the show's literally going to be the Doctor and his companions just sort of hiding in places and watching things happen.
Yes, which is kind of what the Reign of Terror is. And I think the Reign of Terror is comfortably the weakest of the Hartnell historicals. And it is partly because it doesn't have a good villain. It doesn't have a T'Toxil or a T'Gano or even a character like Nero in it. But also because they actually don't do anything other than just sit in history and watch. You know, they get captured, they escape, they get captured, they escape.
Yeah.
They go and spy on the meeting between Barras and Napoleon. But they don't actually do anything. You know, their big contribution to the attack on the Conciergerie prison is just to get Susan out of there. Whereas I think what they're doing with the Romans, and they're going to do more and more. I mean, the Mythmakers, where the Doctor invents the Trojan horse. What they're starting to do is say, well, if the Doctor's going to go to history, he needs to be an active participant, and that there's got to be some sort of excitement there. Plus, you know, it also means you get sort of fun stuff like Vicky just turning to the Doctor, I think I just poisoned Caesar Nero.
Yes. Yes, and that whole bit, like you said, that whole bit with the map and the fact that... Isn't that amazing the way that Derek Francis just wanders around with it after that and it's burning away in his hand and there's bits flying off it and you're thinking, that's a really good performance. I'd be quite worried at this point.
Speaking of really good performances, though, whilst the Doctor is burning that map accidentally, he's going through his whole pun-filled speech about something they can really get their teeth into. Something very palatable.
Yeah. Something to chew on.
That's right. A roaring success.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. I was just going to say, also, I really liked Rome burning at the end. The little sort of silhouette thing that he did. Very simple, but very effective.
It is. It's very good production values across the board here. And I think this is a very early example of, if you do Rome, then yes, you've got a very good quality designer doing the design work here, but there is a sense in which you can go, okay, I'll go and get some Roman costumes out of the BBC store, I'll go get some Roman columns. Oh, what would be really nice in the market square? A nice marble statue. Well, we've got one of those.
Yeah, it's very much what the BBC is already rich in, isn't it? It's the same with when they do Victorian stuff and things like that. All those sort of period.
Yes, but you know, the sets and the design work here, I would put them as being very, very comparable to I, Claudius, which had a much bigger budget 10 years later.
Yeah, I, Claudius is very, it's very basic though, isn't it? I think the sets on I, Claudius, but hugely effective.
Yes.
God, that's another one I need to rewatch soon, actually.
Oh, you do. It is glorious.
Yeah, I haven't watched that for a few years. Yes, if you like the Romans, do and you're interested, do check out I, Claudius, although I presume many of our listeners already have.
Yeah, look, I think that it is Brian Blessed's finest performance as Augustus, and one of the finest performances of any actor on British television, I think, in that.
Yeah, well, so there's so many incredible performances throughout the whole thing.
Well, John Hurt as Caligula, I mean, that is extraordinarily good.
Yeah, it's a great piece. Oh, and Sean Phillips.
Even if she's the person responsible for convincing Gareth Thomas to leave Blake 7.
Oh, is she?
Yes, apparently he was umming and ahhing about whether to stay on and do a third series of Blake 7, and he bumped into her in the lift or the BBC canteen or something, and she was like, oh, my dear fellow, are you still doing that terrible sci-fi show? You know, you're so much better. Come back to the theatre, love. And that was apparently sort of the moment he's gone, yes, this is embarrassing. My peers are laughing at me. I've got to leave this show.
Oh. I've been laughing. They're bloody jealous. I think Sean Phillips wanted to be Servalent secretly. Now, what you're all really waiting for, listeners, isn't it, is all the gen on what the Doctor calls Ian in the Romans. He calls him Chesterton once, Chesterfield once, young man once, my dear boy once, my boy once, and my dear chap once. So that's not very imaginative. You do wonder whether they actually, in the script, just call him dear boy all the time, and Bill Hartnell just keeps mixing them up a lot.
To be fair, they're only together for about 10 minutes in the whole story.
Yes, that's true. Yes, that is interesting, isn't it, how they split them like that?
And at least the Chesterfield, they do get one of the funniest lines in the...
Yeah.
That is good, that, yeah.
Brilliant.
I think he's definitely changed here. What's next after this? Is it,
The Web Planet.
Web Planet.
I mean, he's not quite the giggling, mischievous elf there, is he? So,
No, and then you go on to the Crusades, which is a very well-written historical, and that's not a funny historical or a comedy historical.
No.
That is a very sort of old-school one, and it's a wonderful story. But even there, he still gets to have a bit of fun. And the bit where the princess, played by Jean Marsh, suddenly discovers that Vicky isn't a boy after all, but is actually a girl, Hartnell has a lot of fun in that scene.
I can't remember that. I mainly remember that as the novelisation, rather than the...
Yeah, it's that wonderful old television conceit that, well, if we put a girl into pants and a top, no one will know she's a girl. Everyone will assume she's a boy, you know. It's the thing that the Blackadder takes off with Bob.
Oh, Bob.
By the way, one of the women slaves is played by someone called Dorothy Rose Gribble. So, don't know if she's an ancestress of our own Hayden.
Well, I think it's actually a descendant, because at some point Hayden goes back in time to... father another child to ensure that the Romans can happen.
Have we got anything to say more about the Romans?
The only thing I'll say, since you've brought up the credits, is that in the one of the episodes, there is actually an actor who is credited as Titulinus / Man with Cup.
In that case, and I should have done this for the rescue, actually, marks out of 10 for the Romans, I would give it a 7.5.
Shall I go next? And let the guest have the final say?
Yes.
I think I would go... I think it's brilliant. I would give it a 9. Happily.
Oh, wow.
I will score both of these stories together, and collectively I will also give them a 9. I think it's sort of a 10. It doesn't quite have the epic classic qualities that a 10 out of 10 has for me, but it's very well written. It's definitely a 9. But as Mark alluded to earlier, if you ask me to make a list of the stories that just make me happy and are just fun to watch, these two, particularly the Romans, would be absolutely in the top 5 of that list.
What would you give Rescue Mark out of 10?
I would have given that about 8.5.
Really? Look at me.
Yeah, because I don't see where I can dock points from it, apart from the malarkey with the trap. That's the only thing I can mark it down
for. It's the only fault of the story.
I'd give it another 7.5, I think. I must admit, I was rewatching Romans the last few days. I did keep falling asleep enjoying it.
It's been a treat for me rewatching both of these stories.
So can I ask you, you've now watched a few stories that others have recommended to you as being personal favourites of them, but ones that maybe don't get attention. How did these two stories stand up compared to some of the other nominations?
That'd be Horns of Nymon, wouldn't it?
I would probably prefer Nymon over this, because I do find, as much as I enjoyed some of the characterisation in Romans, I didn't really find the plot particularly interesting. Rescue, pretty much the same, really. Always good watching the TARDIS team, but apart from the costume of Coquillion, there's not much really in that I would rush to watch again. What else did we do that people recommended? I can't remember, really.
Well, Hayden did the Web of Fear with you, I think.
Oh, right, yes.
Oh, yes, we did that. I always found that. I found the novelisation. It's just a wonder for me whether the novelisation or the TV version is the more boring of the Web of Fear. I found that dreadfully boring. Just doesn't interest me at all. Stylistically and design-wise, amazing, I thought, but very, very boring.
So can I ask you both, given that the real motivation for me in putting these two stories forward to you gents in the Hoosian, but also to the listeners, was to really sell William Hartnell and show the best of Hartnell, did he go up in your estimation watching these, or did you enjoy him more watching these?
I think for me, it definitely compounded and reaffirmed what I like about William Hartnell and what I think about his Doctor. But with a lot of these stories, I do find my estimations of the Doctors, if they're stories I haven't watched for a couple of years, but I've had it with some Sylvester McCoys and some John Pertwees lately as well. And if I'm given the right story, then the Doctor does suddenly start going up my list of favourite Doctors. And that's definitely happened watching these, I would say. To actually sit down, concentrate, and really focus on his performance.
I'm enjoying giggling. I enjoy this sort of elfin sprite version of the first Doctor, but I do think that if you're then moving on to a much more serious story, I'm not sure it would work. I quite like all versions of him, really, because it's basically on how he interacts with Ian and Barbara. So when he's a miserable old git in the a crotchety old man in the earlier parts of the of this era, they're not just standing there taking it and saying, oh, God, he's being nasty to us, isn't he cruel? They're actually reacting well against it and fighting back against him when he's being a crotchety old man. Whereas here, when he changes his personality, they change the way they react. They're almost taking an endearing attitude towards the Doctor.
Well, they actually grow. It is what we would call now a character arc in knowing terms.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. The Doctor's character arc with Ian goes from, how dare you come into my junkyard, sir, to, Ian, I could kiss you in the train.
Well, it's funny though, isn't it? Because a lot of the... I mean, I'm not sure if it's so much these days, maybe, but a lot of people criticise early and classic Doctor Who for not having character arcs. Yeah, it's littered with them.
Yes, I think that a lot of the criticisms that some people make of the classic era, and particularly the 60s, are demonstrably not true, and these 6 episodes go a long way to proving that.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, a lot of the arcs in New Who are actually plot arcs, aren't, or story arcs, as opposed to character arcs. Yes.
That's right.
The Eccleston year, yeah. It is, because Rose goes from being a shop girl to the saviour of the universe. The Doctor goes from being a PTSD victim to sacrificing himself to save Rose. He goes from being a killer when he's wiped out the Time Lords and the Daleks to be, at the end of Party of the Ways, coward or killer, coward any day, which is... And that's a very Doctor Who arc, isn't it? Because normally you might think, oh, you start as the coward and you become brave and you become the killer.
Yes, and I think that's why the Eccleston era is still my favourite era of the new series, and he's still my favourite Doctor of the new Doctors.
Oh, it's glorious.
It really is.
You know, I teased Chris about some of his professional northerner, professional working class man stuff, but I do find that era, the nonsense that we've had generally in recent years, the pandemic, the way politics is going, particularly in the UK and everything. I look back on that 2015 as... It seems rather shallow.
2015, 2005.
Sorry, 2005. Shallow to say, oh, I found that really happy year because a TV series was on. But it was... If you ignored idiots like Gary Bushell writing reviews about it in The Sun, everyone seemed to be on board with how amazing this new Doctor Who was, wasn't it? When they were doing it, we're building up to Parting of the Ways, and they were doing, I think on the TV they kept putting up that starscape behind the Earth and a countdown of it. And when they were building up to Rose and they were doing things like on the screen, the BBC, he's back and it's about time, you actually felt that, I'm sure they didn't, but the whole country and the whole of fandom, obviously not just restricting countries to the UK, was really behind it and excited about it.
No, yeah, it was a very, very exciting time to be a fan, and it delivered in such a wonderful way. And, you know, maybe part of it is nostalgia, but I still hold the Eccleston era up very good, and I think you're right to draw a parallel between the character arcs of the Hartnell era and the character arcs of the Eccleston era. I think that's an absolutely fair and really sensible point.
And this is what I was going to say when we were talking about, David, you were saying, I think that in Series 1 they should have completely rebooted him as a new First Doctor. I think he almost tried to do that with the Time War, but I think as the series became more and more popular, and he starts doing things that he couldn't resist bringing back the Time Lords as yet another extravagant finale.
Yeah.
And so he almost inevitably starts tying things in into backstory. He starts thinking possibly when he's Russell T. Davis's writing Series 1, he's thinking, I've got to make this good, because if this tanks this series and the BBC gets rid of Doctor Who, they'll probably never bring it back again. But then once it's being amazingly popular during David Tennant's time, then perhaps he does become slightly self-indulgent. I'll bring back the Time Lords. I'll bring back the Master. All this stuff. And so it inevitably becomes enmired in canon again. Any thoughts, Dave, about the coming new series of Doctor Who? Jodie's Third?
Yeah, I'm trying not to have thoughts because I do like to go in without too much apprehension or too much preconception.
Sure, you'll be disappointed.
Well, maybe, but I go in wanting what I always want, which is just fun adventures in time and space. I don't want huge big plot arcs. I don't need new big revelations. I just want good fun adventures. And most of the last series, I thought, did deliver that. It failed a bit in the last couple, but most of the time they were just good fun adventures in the past or the future or on Earth. And if they keep doing that, I'll be a happy viewer.
Do you think this will be Jodie's last series?
Probably, but I'm not as certain as some people.
Any thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, like Dave, I try not to have too many preconceptions. I think I always approach the new series, well, I've certainly approached the last series with a sense of dread. And I suspect I will... This time as well, I'd be interested to see if something happens with the Timeless Children thing. I'm still hoping that it'll turn out to be...
A dream.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that the Master's going to come out of the shower or something. I don't know.
Oh, I wish.
Well, I mean, I guess a lot of people have that dream.
I'd almost want to start myself a career as a TV writer. so that one day I could take over the show and make it canon that the Master was making all this up. Because I just think it's the most catastrophically dreadful idea.
But as far as Jodie's staying, 3 years does, oh, three seasons does seem about normal, and it's going to have been a long while that she's been there as well, isn't it, with all the breaks they've had. Although she won't have done that many stories, will she? I guess compared to previous Doctors. I don't know, but also we're not far away from thinking about the 60th, are we?
No,
not really.
You know, only sort of 2 years. So I can't see Chibnall giving up the post before the... And I can't see a big change before the 60th, but, yeah, it could be Jodie's last.
Something I read somewhere the other day is, you know, don't you, that by hitting 2021, we are now 16 years away from when the series restarted, which is as long as the series was away from being cancelled in 1989 when it restarted.
Oh.
It doesn't seem like that, does it? Because it always seems, the Wilderness Years seems like decades, doesn't it? When someone says, oh, it was only 16 years, actually. It's quite a surprise.
Yes, I find it very, very strange to think that us looking back at Eccleston now is like somebody watching the Pirate Planet and thinking of an unearthly child.
Yeah.
Blimey.
Imagine having... I'm not going to say that because it's not very kind. Right then. Well, Dave, thanks for joining us. So where can we find you normally?
I co-host the Doctor Who Show, which you can find on social media and on all good podcast hosting sites. I also co-host a Blake 7 podcast, which is called Spacefall. And we have previously completed the whole run of The Goodies on the Goodies Pirate podcast.
And occasionally you crop up on the 42 to Doomsday podcast, don't you? Just to keep them in line.
When they need somewhere to record, they invite me along so they can use my house.
What's happened to Spacefall, by the way?
Richard's basically had to do lots of working from home and schooling from home. And we've got a few that are recorded, but I've done the first edit and he usually does the second edit. And he just hasn't had time to do the edits. And we also had a long period where we couldn't actually visit each other to record them either. So, and we did want to record them in person. We didn't want to just do Skype because we do like that sort of in-person dynamic if you can do it. So there are some in the can, but yeah, editing needs to happen.
Links to all of these at our show notes over on our podcast blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, of course.
I'll just say, look, thank you very much for inviting me to the Whoseum. I've learnt a lot. It's been a pleasure, but I'll now contact the Adric and tell them it's time to leave. Adric, this is Dave. Teleport now.
It's quite unusual having someone on who's clearly thought about the stories we're going to talk about.
Ouch.
It's certainly not anything the three of us ever do, is it, Mark?
Well, no.
Here come the Sons of Skaro. Dalek Skaros, have you got an update for us on the government's pandemic advice?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Ray, we have anti-Dalek force ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap!
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dumb Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydumb, on Twitter at diddly_dumb, or email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dumb. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.